Blog Talk Radio.
What up? I am back live tonight. You're listening to a live show, Aunt Canary Experience. I'm your host, Aunt Canary. I've been out for a couple of weeks trying to take care of some business because tonight I am transmitting live from the new underground secret lair that I had been talking about for so long. It took me a while to get everything together. Finally got everything together. I am sitting here right now in the new underground lair, and I am so glad. I'm glad to be here with you tonight for the next hour and a half. Also, this is on the south side of Raleigh. So I'm in the hood. And, you know, for some reason, when people say hood, they think not all hoods are bad. This is a good hood. And I'm going to be here for a while. So hopefully from here on out, as long as I'm doing the show, I'll be sitting right here in the same spot doing the show on Tuesday nights from 8 to 9:30 as usual. If you want to call in, if you don't have the number, here's the number, 563-999-3682, 563-999-3682. And tonight, before I talk about, say what I'm talking about, I've been gone for a couple of weeks trying to get stuff situated, and a whole lot of stuff has been going on internationally, in this country. I mean, everything's going crazy. And this past weekend, we had another white domestic terrorist, but this time in New Zealand. The people in New Zealand called him what this clown is, and they arrested him alive. He killed 50 people, injured about 50 others. They called him a domestic terrorist, but for some reason, your president couldn't do the same. And one thing about that, I made a mistake. A friend of mine at work had the video of this crap, and I watched maybe 20 seconds of it. I couldn't do it. But this mess looked like it was straight out of a video game. I lie to you not. First person, like one of these Call of Duty games, and this clown is just shooting people. I stopped watching. I didn't want to watch the shit to begin with, but I stopped watching. He shot a woman in the street and then ran up on her, and while she was in the street dead, he shot her multiple times after that. These are some sick bastards. But as we're already used to, and we're already what we're going to see, is that when white people do this type of thing, they're crazy. When black people do this type of thing, they're thugs. When Muslims do this kind of thing, then it's the entire religion. Which I find strange is that, you know, when you have white people doing this, you don't call out every white person. But if a Muslim had gone into a church and killed people, then there would have been everybody would have been down on the religion. So, you know, there's just double standard. It's just crazy. This clown flashing white power signs, put out some stupid manifesto that I haven't even seen and don't care to see. Don't want to see it, don't care to read it, made a comment that Trump was pretty much his hero and all this other. So what does Trump say? Absolutely nothing. And he wants to try to brush it off and put it on somebody else. Now, Trump may not have pulled the trigger, but he had something to do with this stuff. Whenever this kind of stuff happens, you know, he can run for cover all he wants, but we know the deal. You know, he decided he wanted to ban an entire people of a certain religion. And, you know, if you go back to that Muslim ban, just check out the countries that, you know, he banned. You know, he makes signals with his hands. He every now and again he'll talk or whatever. And then, you know, then I guess he thinks or pretends that nobody's going to understand what he's saying. But we know the deal. Had that happen, we had the scandal with schools happening. And what's jacked up about that is that, you know, these people paying all this money to get these kids in school, and half these kids probably don't even want to be there. But yet you have other kids that don't have that kind of money, that want to go to school, can't go to school because of finances or whatever. And then you have a lot of these people, not all of them, but, you know, screaming and hollering about affirmative action. But yet and still, you have people spending $100,000 $500,000 to get your kids in school, and then what do? They get up in there partying and whatever, and I mean the whole thing, you know, cheating, grades, I mean the whole nine. It's jacked up. It's really jacked up. But you know, that's the world we live in. I think one night I may just do just all news, you know, because this right, you know, there's way too much crazy stuff going on. Way too much crazy stuff. But tonight we're going to talk about something that, you know, again, you may or may not have heard about, things that you might have heard about them, then again, you might not have heard about them. But we're going to talk about, title of the show tonight is, What is Racial Passing? And I've got some clips for you to listen to. I've got some reading and all that good stuff. But in a minute, I'm going to read you something, and I want you to understand. And I'm going to try to emphasize it. And I want you to understand something. That the biggest problem in this country, I think, is that this country is hung up on race. It's been hung up on race for quite a while. I mean, you could pretty much say that this country was built on not only on the backs of black people, but it was built on racism. And the reason why I say that is because, as you know, white people came over here from Europe. They killed off the Native Americans. And then for some reason, somebody got the bright idea of, hey, let's go to Africa, kidnap people, make them work, because, you know, we just don't feel like doing it, but we'll reap the benefits. And that's pretty much what they did. And then the jacked up thing about that is all of a sudden, you know, people like that want to call black people lazy. Well, that's funny considering that this country was built on the backs of black folk. So if you want to talk about lazy, you probably want to look in the mirror. Because like I said, all the other side did claim, took credit for a lot of the stuff that our ancestors did. And now you've got people in this country thinking that they're going to just have an all-white country, which is bullshit. You're not going to have an all-white country. This country has never been all-white. I hate to break it to you. This country has never been all-white. I would suggest to you that if you want to live in an all-white, well, it's not going to be a country, but if you want to live somewhere all-white, you should probably go up in the mountains somewhere and buy land and get all the white folk you can get and just, you know, knock yourself out there. But the thing is, you're not going to find any pure white people. You're not going to find any pure nothing. Nobody's pure anything. We're all mixed up. And you know whose fault that is? The white guys, the white settlers. And I'm going to read you something about that in just a second. The white guys, the white settlers that came over here and took and plundered and raped and murdered and whatever they did, they're the ones that got this stuff started. You are not going to find any pure nothing. And that's, you know, you can do DNA tests, which I'm going to do one day. I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to do it. Because we are all mixed up with everything else. And it's because of those settlers. Now, if those settlers had decided not to come here and to stay where they were at, then, you know, who knows how it would have turned out. They are to blame for all this stuff. So then they turn around and then they want to scream about a white nation, all white nation. That's not going to happen. Ain't going to happen, Captain. So somebody should tell you. If you don't know, now you know. You're not going to have an all-white nothing, because your ancestors back in the day, they dipped. They got with the swirl. Once they went black, they didn't go back. And so that's where you had children of mixed race. So once that gets started, you're not putting that back in, you're not putting that toothpaste back in the tube. It's already out. You are not getting that back. So it's funny to me, and I get on people about, on social media about this all the time. You're not going to have an all-white nothing. No matter how hard you try, no matter how loud you think you're going to scream and rant and rave and have a marches with tiki torches trying to think you're tough, which you're not. There's nothing tough about you walking down the street with tiki torches. You know, if you want to do that shit, why don't you do it on the black side of town? Pick the blackest side of any town you want to do and then do that and see what happens to you. So if you think you're tough walking down the street, okay, you look real tough to the cameras, but that's about it. You're not really tough. So to get out here ranting and raving about all white anything ain't going to happen. So tonight's subject is, what is racial passing? And the short definition of that is, racial passing occurs when a person classified as a member of one racial group is accepted as a member of a racial group other than their own. Historically, the term has been used primarily in the United States to describe a person of color or multiracial ancestry who has assimilated into the white majority during times when legal and social conventions classify the person as a minority subject to racial segregation and discrimination regardless of their actual ancestry. Now, here's the part I want to read, and I want you to understand this. To fully understand how some African-American people pass as white, one must acknowledge the rape of slave women at the hands of white plantation owners. Although there were laws that outlawed this type of thing. Outlawing racial intermarriage existed in America as early as 1664. There were no laws preventing the rape of enslaved women. For generations, enslaved black mothers bore mixed race children deemed mulattoes, quadroons, octoroons, or even hexadecaroons, based on the percentage of white blood. So, let me read that to you again. To fully understand how some African American people pass as white, one must acknowledge the rape of slave women at the hands of white plantation owners. So not only were our ancestors considered property, these guys, you know, and about a year ago or so, I did a story on Andrew Jackson, Sally Hemings. He's the white president. She's African-American. She's an African slave. And he had children with her, you know, bunches of children with her. And a lot of plantation owners did the same thing. So that's how you come up with light skin. You know, you had white, you had black. And in our community, we have, you know, light-skinned people. We have dark-skinned people. We have brown. I'm a nice golden brown, I guess. So there's many shades of black people. And there are light-skinned people, some that are light that you would think that they're white, and they're not, but they can pass. Matter of fact, there was an episode of Sanford and Son where he had Fred had ate too much, and he was sick. So he had to call for a doctor to come see him at his house. And the doctor looked like he was light-skinned, had I haven't seen an episode in a while, but he was light. He had, looks like he had curly hair. And right before the doctor was getting ready to leave the house, Fred asked him if he wanted a drink before he left. And he said, "You want some Ripple?" And the doctor was like, "Ripple?" Like he had never heard it before. And he was like, oh, I thought you were trying to pass. So he thought that the doctor was a light-skinned black guy, which I think he probably, to me, like he might have been maybe, he might have been Jewish, maybe. Like, you know, I'm guessing either Jewish or maybe Italian, maybe. I'm not sure. But it was just funny the way he said it. So, you know, it was pretty much like, I thought you was trying to pass. So he just thought he was going, you know, trying to be, you know, light skinned brother. although the aforementioned mixed race people were often half white or more, institutions of hypocident, man, I can't read this. In the 20th century, one drop rule classified them as black and therefore inferior, particularly after slavery became a racial caste. But there were other mixed race people who were born to unions or marriages in colonial Virginia between free white women and African or African American men, free, indentured, or slave, and became ancestors to many free families of color in the early decades of the U.S., as documented by Paul Hennig in his Free African Americans of Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Maryland, and Delaware. So not only do you have light-skinned children born of white fathers and black mothers, but there was also white women having babies with black men. So that right there throws that all-white crap right out the window. The window, so you got to worry about that. Mixed race African Americans sometimes use a racial and often majority European ancestry in order to pass as white and evade restrictions against them to seek better lives. For some people, passing as white and using their whiteness to uplift other black people was the best way to undermine the system that regulated black people to a lower position in society. Although reasons behind passing are deeply individual, the history of African Americans passing as white can be categorized by the following time periods: the antebellum era, post-emancipation, Reconstruction, through Jim Crow and present day. During the antebellum period, passing as white was a means of escaping slavery. Once they left the plantation, escaped slaves who could pass as white found safety in their perceived whiteness. To pass as white was to pass as free. However, once they gained their freedom, most escaped slaves intended to return to blackness. Passing as white was a temporary disguise used to gain freedom. Once they had escaped, the racial ambiguity could be a safeguard to their freedom. If an escaped slave was to pass as white, they were less likely to be caught and returned to their plantation. If they were caught, white passing slaves such as Jane Morrison could sue for their freedom using their white appearance as justification for emancipation. Post-emancipation, passing as white was no longer a means to obtain freedom. Passing shifted from a necessity to an option. It fell out of favor in the black community. Author Charles Chestnut, who was born free in Ohio as a mixed-race African-American, explored circumstances for persons of color in the South after emancipation, for instance, for a young woman who marries a white man. Some fictional exploration coalesced around the figure of the tragic mulatta, a woman whose future is compromised by her being mixed race and able to pass as white. During the Reconstruction era, black people slowly gained the constitutional rights of which they were deprived during slavery. Although they would not secure full constitutional equality for another century until after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, Reconstruction promised African Americans legal equality for the first time. Abolishing slavery did not abolish racism. During Reconstruction, whites tried to enforce white supremacy, in part through the rise of the KKK chapters, rifle clubs, and later paramilitary insurgent groups such as the Red Shirts. Passing was used by some African Americans to evade segregation. Those who were able to pass as white often engaged in tactical passing or passing as white in order to get a job, go to school, or to travel. Outside these situations, tactical passers still lived as black people, and for this reason, tactical passing is also referred to as 9-to-5 passing. So what they did was they passed as white to get a job from 9-to-5, and then after 5 o'clock, they went back to being black. Because they could do that. The idea of crossing the color line at different points in one's life is explored in James Weldon Johnson's autobiography of an ex-colored man. But the narrator closes the novel by saying, quote, "I have sold my birthright for a mess of pottage," end quote, meaning that he regrets trading his blackness for whiteness. The idea that passing as white was a rejection of blackness. The idea that passing as white was a rejection of blackness was common at the time and remains so to the present time. People also chose to pass for good during Jim Crow and beyond. The U.S. civil rights leader Walter Francis White, who was blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and very fair, was of mixed race, mostly European ancestry. 27 of his 32 great-great-great-grandparents were white. The other 5 were classified as black and had been slaves. He grew up with his parents and family in Atlanta in the black community and identified with it. He served as the chief executive of the NAACP, from 1929 until his death in 1955. In the earliest stages of his career, he conducted investigations in the South, during which he sometimes passed as white in order to gather information more freely on lynchings and hate crimes and to protect himself in hostile and socially hostile environments. Let me see. They've got a few other examples. I'm going to read them all. Let's see. An example is of now. Passing as white in the 21st century is more controversial. It is often seen as a rejection of blackness, family, and culture. And the main matter of fact, we're going to play something about, in a few minutes about her. You all should remember Rachel Dolezal, who was white, but she passed as black. She worked as a civil rights activist. Her attempt at passing was in order to gain the support of the black community. She became president of the Spokane chapter of the NAACP before her parents identified her as white. So the term white passing refers to someone who identifies with a person of color but benefits from white privilege due to their appearance. And this is interesting. I didn't know this, but if you're my age, which I'm 50, you may remember the old, they had some commercials on about littering back in the day. This country had a really bad problem with the trash. I remember, people just throwing, you'd be in the car riding somewhere and you just throw whatever paper out the window, cups. I mean, whatever you had, you just chuck that shit right out the window. And, it'd fly out the window and fall on, side of the road and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it was just real bad for whatever reason. It was real bad. And there was a commercial, an Indian, Native American, named Iron Eyes Cody, But guess what? He wasn't an Indian. He wasn't Native American. He was Sicilian. But he played the part of an American Indian. And he played, he was an actor. He played other parts in movies as a Native American. He wore his film costumes full time and insisted that he was of Cherokee and Cree descent, which he wasn't. But we thought he was. And if you want, you can, you know, get on YouTube and look up the old I don't remember the names of the what they would call it, the commercials, but they were commercials about littering, and he'd be out, and then he had the little he had the tear running down, you know. Somebody, I can't remember, somebody threw something in the water or some mess like that. And then he turned toward the camera, the camera turned toward him, and you see a tear rolling out one of his eyes. That was Iron Eyes Cody, and he wasn't Native. Thought he was, but he wasn't. So he passed. Let's see. Oh, here's another example. The Wall Street Journal reported on October 5th, 2015, that Dartmouth College fired the director of its Native American programs, Susan Taft Reed, after tribal officials and alumni accused her of misrepresentation. She wasn't American, Native American. Dartmouth, this is Bowdoin, B-O-W-D-O-I-N, Bowdoin College, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Let's see. Now we're going to get back to Miss Dolezal. Civil rights activist Rachel Dolezal, then president of the Spokane chapter of the NAACP, claimed in a February 2015 profile to have been born in a Montana teepee and have hunted for food with her family as a child with bow and arrows. She primarily identified as African American and had established herself as an activist in Spokane. In 2015, her mother disputed her daughter's accounts, saying that the family's ancestry was Czech, Swedish, and German, with faint traces of Native American heritage. She also denied various claims made by her daughter about her life, including having lived in Africa when young, although the parents did live there for a time after Dolezal had left home. Dolezal ultimately resigned from her position at the Spokane NAACP chapter. You may know this actress, Mindy Kaling. In 2015, her brother, and his last name is Jack, and I ain't even going to try to pronounce it, but his first name is VJ, told CNN that he had pretended to be black years before in order to take advantage of affirmative action to be admitted into medical school. The medical school issued a statement that said that his grades and scores met the criteria for acceptance at the time, and race had played no factor in his admission. And him and his sister are Indian, and she looks like she could pass for black. And where I work, and in this part of, not this part of Raleigh, but there's a small town outside of Raleigh that is made mostly of Indian people. Work with them every day, see them every day. I have to go through it every day, so I see them all the time. They have Indian restaurants all over the place. I mean, it's, you know, Indian, you know, not Native American Indian, but Indians from India. And some of those guys, I mean, beautiful people. And some of those guys are darker than me. They could pass for black if they wanted to. That's how dark they are. Some of them are. So let me read you a few examples of this in popular culture, and then we're going to get to the eclipse. And I'm not going to read all of these because it's quite a big list. I'll just read you some of them. Mark Twain's 1894 novel, The Tragedy of Pudd'nhead Wilson, is a scathing satire of passing in the antebellum South. Roxy, a slave, is 1/16th black. In order to avoid being sold down the river, she decides to switch her own baby, who is 1/32 black, child she is caring for. Her baby, Tom, who passes for white, is raised as a spoiled aristocrat, but when his true identity becomes known as the child of a slave and thus born into slavery, he is sold down the river. Let me see. Let me find another interesting one here. Let me see what we got. Another one. 1912, James Weldon Johnson anonymously published the autobiography of an ex-colored man, which depicts the life of a biracial man who, after witnessing a lynching, chooses to live as white. Doing so causes him to lose his connection to and dream of making music steeped in African-American roots. Let's see, another one. Matter of fact, you probably heard of this one. This is a movie. Fanny Hurst, 1933 best-selling novel, Imitation of Life, includes the character Piola, a light-skinned African-American girl who rejects her darker-skinned mother in order to pass for white. Two movies about that, and I haven't seen either one. Boris Vianz, I think that's how you say his last name. 1946 pulp fiction novel. It's in the title's in France, but it's been translated to "I Spit on Your Graves." Describes the story of Lee Anderson, an African American man passing as white, who infiltrates a white community by charm and seduction in order to take violent revenge for the lynching of his little brother. The novel was extremely controversial and banned in some authorities. Ray Spriggel, I think that's how you say his last name, a white journalist, disguised himself as black and traveled in the Deep South with John Wesley Dobbs, a guide from the NAACP. Spriggel wrote a series of articles under the title "I Was a Negro in the South for 30 Days." The articles formed the basis of Spriggel's 1949 book, "And the Land of Jim Crow." Langston Hughes wrote several pieces related to passing, including two relevant short stories, one titled Passing in the 1934 collection, The Ways of White Folks, concerns a son who thanks his mother for literally disregarding him on the street as he is passing for white. Passing for whom? For who? Portrays a couple whose racially ambiguity leads to questioning whether they are passing for white or for black. Black Like Me. I did a show on this one. 1961 was an account by journalist John Howard Griffin about his experiences as a white Southern man passing as black in the late 50s to explore how blacks were treated in the Deep South. Let's see if I can find another one. Here's a science fiction story that I hadn't heard about. Harlan Ellison examines the emotional impact of passing in his short story, Pennies Off a Dead Man's Eyes. In it, a white man, secretly an alien, non-human, who was stranded on Earth as a child, attends the funeral of a beloved black man who raised him and who taught him how to blend in and appear human. I never heard of that story before. I'm almost to the end of these. Let's see. What else? See, I already said something about imitation of life. Let's see what else. Trying to see if I can find something that you probably heard of. Melvin Van Peebles, 1970, Watermelon Man. And I've seen some of this, but I didn't see all of it. I need to see it. Watermelon Man tells the story of a casually racist white man who wakes up black and its effect this has on his life. And that was a comedy. I started seeing some of that, but I didn't see the whole thing. 1973 film, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. I've seen some of this, but not the whole thing. Features a bank robbery conducted by an African-American underground guerrilla group, lighter-skinned members, who with their hair wigs passes white, are purposefully used. Witnesses to the crime described them as Caucasian males, deflecting suspicion from the guerrillas. As a matter of fact, this next one, I had seen this one a couple of days ago, The Jerk, with Steve Martin. He was a white guy, but he was raised by a black family, so he considered himself to be black. There was a movie 1986 called Soul Man. I had a white guy, and he wore blackface to get into Harvard Law School. Let's see. And there are quite a few other movies. White Chicks. They played white girls. So there are. Oh yeah, and there was one soap opera that I forgot about. The Jeffersons. If you remember, they had a mixed couple. Had a son and a daughter. The daughter was black. The son was white. Well, he looked white. Also, there was a skit. As a matter of fact, this is on YouTube. I've seen it. A few months ago, where Eddie Murphy played a white guy. And you know, they didn't know he was black, but he would just walk. I mean, he'd walk into the bank to go for a loan, and they were just giving him cash. And you know, it was funny to watch. So you gotta find that and watch that. There was back in '85, and I remember this because I used to watch The Young and the Restless. They had a black character that passed as a white guy. He was a black lawyer. He passed as a white guy to infiltrate the mob. So you have to probably go way back to look for that. There are quite a few other ones that you can look for. So those are just some examples in a little background of what we're talking about tonight. Racial passing. So this first clip. Oops, wait a minute. I got to get my paper so I can make sure I hit the right button and tell you what this is about. So the first clip, a little bit more definition of what it means to pass. That's 12 minutes long, which is cool, but it gives you more information. So we'll play it and we'll be right back.
Thank you so much. I am a historian. I love history. I fell in love with history because I've always been surrounded by it. I grew up in a town in New Jersey where George Washington spent 2 winters during the Revolutionary War. As an undergraduate, I was a tour guide at Harvard, and I used to love telling prospective students about the Great Fire of 1764. That engulfed the campus and destroyed John Harvard's prized book collection. When I started graduate school at the University of Chicago, history continued to surround me. But this time, it was my own history. It was my family's history that met me at every turn. I lived on Chicago's South Side in Hyde Park, which is one of the most historic African-American neighborhoods in the country. So history, once distant in New Jersey and at Harvard, was suddenly getting closer and closer to me. Here was the apartment where my father and my aunt, pictured here as children, lived when they moved to Chicago after migrating from Augusta, Georgia in 1939. Here was Wendell Phillips High School, one of Chicago's first predominantly African-American high schools. This high school was a source of pride and an anchor in the Black community. This was also where my parents met and went to their prom together. Carl Sandburg famously described Chicago as the hog butcher for the world and the city of big shoulders. But to me, Chicago was a place where my family's history came to life. Now, there was one story that my aunt shared with me about my family's history that was so compelling, but also so tragic, that I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it was the story of a distant cousin of ours who had grown up on Chicago's South Side. She lived a life like any other Black child of her time. She went to Wendell Phillips High School, and she cheered as the historic Bud Billiken Parade made its way through Washington Park. But her life would take a dramatically different turn when she graduated from high school. My cousin was very light-skinned. She looked white. And her mother had decided that it was in her best interest to leave the South Side of Chicago and move far away to Los Angeles and pass as a white woman. Now, my cousin did not want to do this. She pleaded with her mother. She did not want to leave her family and her friends and the only life that she had ever known. But her mother was insistent, and the matter was decided. So years later, after my cousin had married a white man and raised white children who knew nothing of their mother's past, she received a very inconvenient phone call. It was her mother, and she was calling to tell her that her father was dying and that she must come home immediately. Despite these dire circumstances, my cousin would never return to Chicago's South Side. She was a white woman now, and there was simply no turning back. Now, this is all that my family knows about this story, so we can only imagine how her life unfolded. We can only imagine how she must have felt, knowing that her father was dying and that she would never see him again. This had to have been a heartbreaking loss, but this was not even the only loss that she would experience. Once she passed as white, she was gone from the Black community. She would never go to another Bud Billiken parade. She would never smell the hot dogs that were sold at the parade. She would never hear the sounds of the marching bands as they made their way through the park. And she would never have the joy of sharing this experience with her own children. So this story really stayed with me, and I've been wrestling with it ever since my aunt shared it with me. And as a historian and as a scholar, I've always kept history at arm's length. That's what we're trained to do. But I couldn't be dispassionate about this story. I knew that as a historian I was supposed to be objective, but I couldn't let this story go. It wouldn't let me go. So I decided to write a history of racial passing. Now, conventional wisdom says that you can't write a history of racial passing, that there's no records, because the people who passed were so careful to make sure that there was no trace of their transgression, that they were careful to make sure that they couldn't be found. But I believed that the sources were out there, and I believed that they were waiting for a historian to discover. So I went out looking for ghosts. I went into the archives looking for ghosts in the hopes that I could tell their story. And what I found was that writing a history of passing is writing a history of loss. Now, this doesn't quite make sense, because it seems that to pass as white was to gain. To be white, particularly during the period of racial segregation, meant to have a better job. It meant to live in a better neighborhood. It meant the right to vote. It meant to enjoy countless social privileges, everything from sitting at a better table in a restaurant or enjoying a more comfortable seat at a movie theater. But what struck me was not so much what was gained by passing, but rather what was lost by leaving an African-American identity behind. So let me share one story with you from my research that I think elucidates this idea of loss. And this is a story of a woman named Elsie Roxborough. Elsie Roxborough was born into a storied African-American family, but she chose to pass as white in 1937 after she graduated from the University of Michigan. Her story ends in tragedy. She took her own life in 1949. The Roxborough family lived a life during the Great Depression that few Americans could imagine. Elsie rode horses and drove her father's cars. The family had maids and chauffeurs, and they vacationed with other black elites at Idlewild, a prestigious resort nicknamed the Black Eden. One family member said, "We knew times were hard out there. We knew that there were people who were selling apples on the street corners, but not our crowd. We wore white linen jackets to Sunday school." When Elsie arrived at the University of Michigan in 1933, she would become the first black woman to live in a dorm. Elsie's friends described her as driven and ambitious. Elsie had a beauty that few men, black or white, could resist. She was tall and slender, glamorous and vivacious. The poet and novelist Langston Hughes admired her. Her classmate and the future playwright Arthur Miller called her a beauty, the classiest girl in Ann Arbor. Langston Hughes wrote that Elsie used to tell him her dreams, and she used to wonder if maybe if she passed as white, she might be able to achieve them more easily. Elsie did decide to pass. First, she moved to California, and then she moved to New York. And once she arrived in New York, she dropped the famous Roxborough name and became the unattached white Mona Manet. But even as a white woman, her dreams would not come true. When Elsie's white roommate returned from a weekend trip, she found Elsie in her bed. It appeared that she had committed suicide. Elsie's sister could also pass as white, so she traveled to New York with the wrenching assignment of claiming the body. The arrival of this ostensibly white sister allowed Elsie to remain white even in death. Elsie had asked her father for financial help, and he refused her, and 3 days later, she was dead. Elsie's sister would never talk to her father again. I never expected to see myself in my research. I did not choose a different racial identity, but I have walked through a lot of loss in my life. As I was writing this book, I lost my marriage and the life that I had dreamed for myself. I also lost so many loved ones who I cared about so deeply, including two cousins who were like sisters to me, and my dear aunt, the magnificent storyteller who had connected me so closely to my own family history, and who had also told me the story of my cousin that would set my project on passing into motion. And for the last 13 years, I have carried with me the loss of my sister, who died of breast cancer at the age of 31. Writing this book has been a profoundly painful and also emotional journey. But perhaps it was my own experience with loss that helped me to see and to feel so keenly what the subjects in my book felt. As I was writing about Elsie Roxborough, I began to realize just how universal the experience of loss is. Now, certainly, those people who passed as white experienced a very specific kind of loss, a severing of family relationships, and a wondering of what could have been. At some point in each of our lives, we all must walk away from something that we hold dear. And when all that's left are the memories and the fragments, we all wonder what could have been. At some point in each of our lives, we all reach out for someone or for something that is no longer there. Divorce and death are perhaps two of loss's most painful iterations, but we all experience many forms of loss. There's the loss of moving away from home and knowing that you're never going back, or moving away from home and knowing that even if you did go back, it would never be quite the same. So this is why I fell in love with history, because no matter how far we look back, we can always find a history that is so very close to our own. No matter how far we look, we can always find an image of ourselves. And isn't that the beauty of history? For once we realize just how common and just how universal the experience of loss is, doesn't that make it so much easier to bear? Thank you very much.
Okay. That was that clip, pressing, but I think it was important to give you an idea of what some people, you know, went through, you know, trying to pass. The next clip I'm going to play is entitled, "Most People Think I'm White." So these are stories of black people who are very light-skinned, who other people think that they're white when they're actually black.
I identify as a black man with the full understanding that the rest of the world may not share that impression. There have been many times in my life that I wish that I just looked identifiably black, whatever that means, so that at least I would have to deal with people honestly and not pretend to be anything else. There are very, very few people who are mixed race that to me, you cannot visually at least tell that there is something going on. I happened to me, be a bit of a freak show in that white people almost never suspected that I was anything other than white and Jewish, and black people almost never suspected that I was anything other than white and Jewish as well. I'm not ashamed to admit, as a 9-year-old in the 80s, I went with the path of least resistance. Passing for me was a survival mechanism. I could see the way the world treated black Americans, and I made a calculation. I do not want that for my life. The things that helped me realize that passing was sort of a disservice to my legacy and everything that my father had done, and my dad raised me by himself, it was the explosion of Afrocentric thought with, along with the combination of, oh, I'm part of this experience. My family was a direct part of this movement, and I, through passing, I have negated everything they had done.
I am a person of color, but I am white passing. That means that I do have white privilege. I am a Muslim, but I don't wear a hijab. And I am Arab. When I speak to someone who doesn't know where I'm from, or when I speak to someone who does not know my name, they automatically think that I am white. And it's a safe space for me because there's a lot of hate towards Muslims, this hatred towards Arabs that's scary, super scary for someone like me. Having privilege is freaking awesome. Nobody's questioning who you are, and it's that moment when people take that privilege away, you feel it. You feel the full impact of, wow, I am being literally profiled right now, and it feels like crap. What I usually need to share with people especially when it comes to me being ethnically ambiguous. I am Arab, I am Muslim, and I don't judge you. I would appreciate the same from you.
I've been called Peckerwood, I've been called white bitch, I've been called lots of names. Most people think I'm a white woman, and that is both largely a source of privilege for me, and it's also a source of alienation from people who otherwise I would feel comfortable with and part of a community with. A really big part of how race is acted on in our country is based on physical appearance. So I can have all the loving relationships with the black side of my family that I want. When I walk out in the world, I look like this. I think as mixed race people, we still face a lot of pressure from other people who are not comfortable with our identity. I don't think that mixed race people are going to be the saviors of our country, but I think that our lived experience can be beneficial. I think one of the most important things that the burgeoning mixed race population does is that it becomes your neighbor, it becomes your coworker, it becomes the person behind you in the grocery store line. And that demystification of the other is, I think, one of the most critical ways to build bridges across racial divides.
Play is entitled Too White to Be Black, Too Black to Be White. I'm just going to get it on the right button. All right, here we go.
A confused young man looked at his parrain, that's French Creole for godfather, and asked, "What am I? Who am I? Who are my ancestors' kin? I'm fair, my brother's brown, and my sister's of olive skin. My mama says Creole. What is that? Am I supposed to know?"
A typical Creole family was a family mixed with white, black, a touch of Spanish, and in some cases a bit of Indian blood. And I think that can count a lot of New Orleans families like that. The disadvantages, because we were just a little different, some people didn't take to that. They gave us a rough time sometimes. The advantage, my daddy went into the painting business, and I hate to say it, but on many occasions, he didn't tell the people what he was. They accepted him for the way he looked. Some cases people found out later, but once you worked for them, if they liked your work, then you would be called back. If you were real dark-skinned, often they wouldn't give you the chance to get in the front door.
The Creole is like the prototype of a melting pot man. He has a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So I think what makes Creole is that you have to recognize that you are part of many ethnicities. You're not totally African-American. You're not totally French. You're not totally Spanish. You're a combination of everything. And I think recognizing that diversity is unique because you say, this is who I am. You accept me the way I am. I have no control over the fact that I have 7 ethnic groups in 3 generations.
We are mixture of Caucasians and Africans. That's in the family, both on mother's side of the family, on my daddy's side of the family. So you might say we are thoroughbred Creoles. One thing I could remember, my mother on the telephone, when she talked to her sisters, they always spoke in French. And of course, whenever they were talking about me, I knew because they couldn't say Lord in French. So I always got a kick out of that.
Honey, we went from dark brown to blue-eyed blonde. My sister was a platinum blonde as a child, a blonde with blue eyes. And I have first cousins that are dark brown skin. I had one uncle that was brown and 3 uncles that were fair. One had blue eyes. Naturally, the brown one was teased and talked about as a kid because they do that in their own families. They call them the black sheep of the family and things like that.
Many of the children of darker complexions felt inferior. These children never fully were able to enjoy being children. They were so busy worrying about what they looked like. If you were brown, but you had nice hair, you know, if your hair would move, if you had good hair, well, then you were with that crowd with the light skin, who may not have had nice hair, but they had the fair skin. So there was a lot of categorizing, and the children who felt inferior, they carried this forever.
Remember, the Creole word to some people, they get really upset over it. One of my coworkers, I mentioned that word just a few weeks ago, and he told me, he said, that's when you want to be white and you don't want to be black. But to some extent, we are in the middle. We don't want to be uppity. All I want to do is live my life and go on.
My daddy was a very independent person. He loved business. He loved dairy farm, and he loved cows. My father received the tax bill for $600 on the farm and the cattle and whatever. He met with Judge Adams and protested, and he said since he did not have schools for his children, he didn't see why he had to pay it. He said if he had to pay it, he would send his children to that school, that white school right down the highway. Judge Adams told him, for $3,000, I'll have all y'all records changed and everybody will be white. And he told him, go to hell, and that was it.
How can I really know how I came to be? How come we're different complexions? What am I supposed to see? Parrain, the youth besieged him, tell me, why are we so many colors? What does Creole really mean? Who can I call my brothers? Am I black or white? I do not understand. What is my true birthright?
Okay, so the last clip for tonight, and then we'll put a nice big bow on this show. This is a story that that Dr. Joy DeGruy told about an experience that happened to her in a grocery store. I think I played this. It's been a while since I played this. That she had when she was in a grocery store with her, It's either one of her, a cousin or her sister-in-law, something like that. Talking about an embarrassing situation that happened to her, but according to her, she used it as a learning moment. I'll play it. It's not long, and then be right back for closing arguments or whatever you want to say.
Sister-in-law, who's half black, half white, but looks white, blue eyes, whiter than most white folks, very white. She and I, you know, we kind of grew up together. We raised our children together, so they're first cousins, and we, you know, it's a wonderful, very, very multicultural family. So we're going in a Safeway one day, and Kathleen, my sister-in-law, is in front of me, and she's, you know, writing a check for her groceries. Now, my daughter, who at the time was 10 years old, was standing with me, and I was directly behind her, you know, getting ready to get my groceries. So Kathleen comes up, and the checker, who is a strawberry blonde, freckled, very delightful, warm, you know, the checker, this young woman, is talking to Kathleen. Hey, how you doing? Isn't it a nice day today? They're just chatting up. And she says, yeah. So Kathy writes her check, and she steps off to the side with her groceries because she's waiting for me. Of course, again, Kathleen looks white, right? So I come up. No conversation. She looks up at me. Absolutely no, just little chatter. And I write my check. My daughter, however, is 10, notices immediately the difference in how she responds to me. So I write my check, and she goes, I'm going to need two pieces of ID. At which point, my daughter looks at me, and she gets very, very embarrassed, and tears are kind of coming up in her eye, like, Mommy, you're not gonna let her do this. Why is she doing this to us, right? So I'm trying to figure out what I should do, because behind me are two elderly white women, right? And I'm thinking, okay, so then I become the angry black woman, right? And they're going to be, and I'm just trying to second guess all the drama. So then I just give her the two pieces of ID. I said, you know, some things you got to choose your battles, right? And then it gets worse. She pulls out the bad check book, right? So this is the book that shows the people who have written bad checks. So she starts searching for my license in the bad checks, at which point it's just out of control now. Just as I'm standing there trying to decide what to do, and it's really deeply humiliating. Now my daughter is in full-blown emotionally upset, who's 10. My sister-in-law walks back over, and she steps in, and she says, excuse me, why are you doing this? And the checker goes, well, what do you mean? She goes, why are you taking her through all of these changes? Why are you doing that? She goes, well, this is our policy. She goes, no, it's not your policy because you didn't do that with me. Oh, well, I know you. You've been. She goes, no, she's been here for years. I've only lived here for 3 months. And so at this point, the two white elderly ladies go, oh, I can't believe what this checker has done with this woman. It is totally unacceptable. At which point, the manager walks over. So the manager walks over and says, is there a problem here? And then my sister-in-law again responds. She goes, yes, there is a problem here. Here is what happened. So you see, she used her white privilege. And even though Kathleen is half black and half white, she recognizes what that means. And she made the statement. She pointed out the injustice. And she, as a result of that one act, influenced everyone in that space. But what would have happened? I can't know for certain had the black woman said, this is unfair. Why are you doing this to me? Would it have had the same impact? But Kathleen knew that she walked through the world differently than I did. And she used her white privilege to educate and make right a situation that was wrong. That's what you can do every single day.
Oops. Okay. All right. So that's the last clip for tonight. I hope you got something out of this. Unfortunately, America is a very racist country. Very racist country. And for people to pretend that it's not, either they're asleep or they don't want to see. And I think a lot of Trump supporters like this. They see it, but they don't want it. They pretend they don't see it. I had put up a post the other day. It's like, you know, a lot of people, you know, they see it, you know, they seen Bigfoot, they seen aliens, they seen Jesus and toast, but they don't see racism. Even though it's sitting and staring you right there in your face, you still don't see it. So this country is very, very racist, unfortunately. So this is going to be in the end of the tonight show, first night in my new underground lair in Southeast Raleigh, capital of North Kakilaki. Next week, we're going to do a show on famous hoaxes. And what do I mean by hoaxes? Due to the fact we had a black actor pay two black guys to beat him up, pretended it was a racial, whatever you want to call it, for a while, mostly on social media, and mostly white folk, they just kept yapping about it, yapping about it, blah, 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 blah. And then I remember something, you know, you people want to keep talking about this. I got two words for you. Susan Smith. We're going to talk about Susan Smith next week and a couple of other hoaxes that we've had in this country. If you don't know who Susan Smith is or was, I'll give you a week to look her up. And you want to talk about hoax. You know, what Jesse Smollett did was, in my opinion, stupid. But what Susan Smith did was beyond, you know, just off the hook. So if you don't know who she is, look her up. You got a week. That'd be your homework assignment for next week. And then next week we'll be back. We'll be talking about Jesse Smollett's situation, Susan Smith, Tawana Brawley. Remember her? Remember that mess? And there was one more I had in mind, but I didn't write it down, but I'll bring it back. So we'll talk about. So next week we're going to be talking about famous hoaxes that we went through. And until then, I will see you next week. Peace out. Bye-bye.